heard of the term little people?
No, Buzzcut said without missing a beat.
That's fine,
Ushikawa replied. Their conversation came to an end. Buzzcut slowly rose from his chair and straightened the collar of his jacket. Ponytail took one step forward from the wall. Mr. Ushikawa, as I mentioned before, time is of the essence. Buzzcut stood and looked down at Ushikawa, who had remained seated. We have to locate Aomame as soon as possible. We are doing our very best, and we need you to do the same from a different angle. If Aomame isn't found, it could be bad for both of us. You are, after all, one of the few who know an important secret.
With great knowledge comes great responsibility.
Exactly, Buzzcut replied without a trace of emotion. He turned and swiftly exited the room. Ponytail followed Buzzcut out, noiselessly shutting the door. After they had left, Ushikawa pulled open a desk drawer and switched off the tape recorder inside. He opened the lid of the recorder, extracted the cassette tape, and wrote the date and time on it with a ballpoint pen. For a man with his sort of odd looks, his handwriting was neat and graceful. He grabbed the pack of Seven Stars cigarettes beside him, extracted one, and lit it with his lighter. He took a long puff, exhaled deeply toward the ceiling, then closed his eyes for a moment. He opened his eyes and looked over at the wall clock. The clock showed 2:30.
What a creepy pair indeed,
Ushikawa told himself once more. If Aomame isn't found, it could be bad for both of us, Buzzcut had said. Ushikawa had twice visited the headquarters of Sakigake, deep in the mountains of Yamanashi Prefecture, and had seen the huge incinerator in the woods behind the compound. It was built to burn garbage and waste, but since it operated at an extremely high temperature, if you threw a human corpse inside, there wouldn't be a single bone left. He knew that, in fact, several people's bodies had been disposed of in this way. Leader's body was probably one of them. Naturally enough, Ushikawa didn't want to suffer the same fate. Someday he would die, but if possible, he would prefer something a bit more peaceful. But there were some facts that Ushikawa hadn't revealed. Ushikawa preferred not to show all his cards at once. It was okay to show them a few of the lower-value cards, but the face cards he kept hidden. One needed some insurance, like the secret conversation he had recorded. When it came to this kind of game, Ushikawa was an expert. These young bodyguards had nowhere near the experience he had. Ushikawa had gotten a hold of Aomame's private client list. As long as you don't mind the time and effort and you know what you're doing, you can get a hold of almost any kind of information. Ushikawa had made a decent enough investigation of the backgrounds of the 12 private clients, 8 women and 4 men, all of them of high social standing and fairly well off, not a single one the type who would lend a hand to an assassin. But one of them, a wealthy woman in her 70s, provided a safe house for women escaping domestic violence. She allowed battered women to live in a 2-story apartment building on the extensive grounds of her estate, next door to her house. This was, in itself, a wonderful thing to do. There was nothing suspicious about it. Yet something bothered Ushikawa, kicking around the edges of his consciousness. And as this vague notion rattled around in his mind, Ushikawa tried to pinpoint what it was. He was equipped with an almost animal-like sense of smell, and he trusted his intuition more than anything. His sense of smell had saved him a few times. Violence was perhaps the key word here. This elderly woman had a special awareness of the violent, and thus went out of her way to protect those who were its victims. Ushikawa had actually gone over to see this safe house. The wooden apartment building was on a rise in Azabu, prime real estate. It was a fairly old building, but had character. Through the grill of the front gate, he saw a beautiful flower bed in front of the entrance, and an extensive garden. A large oak cast a shadow onto the ground. A small die-cut plate glass was set into the front door. It was the kind of building that was fast disappearing from Tokyo. For all its tranquility, the building was heavily secured. The walls around it were high and topped with barbed wire. The solid metal gate was securely locked, and a German shepherd patrolled the grounds and barked loudly if anyone approached. There were several cameras set up to scan the vicinity. Hardly any pedestrians walked on the road in front of the apartment, so one couldn't loiter there long. It was a quiet residential area with several embassies nearby. If a strange-looking man like Ushikawa were seen loitering, someone would be sure to question his presence. The security was a little too tight. For a place meant to shelter battered women, they went a bit overboard. Ushikawa felt he would have to find out all there was to know about this safe house. No matter how tightly it was guarded, he would somehow have to pry it open. No, the more tightly it was guarded, the more he had to pry it open. And to do so, he would have to rack his brain to come up with a plan. Ushikawa recalled the part of his conversation with Buzzcut concerning the little people. "Have you ever heard the term little people?" "No." The reply had come a little too fast. If you had never heard that name before, you would normally pause a beat before answering. Little people? You would let the sound roll around in your mind for a second to see if anything clicked, and then you would reply. That's what most people would do. Buzzcut had heard the term little people before. Ushikawa didn't know if he knew what it meant or what it was, but it was definitely not the first time he'd heard it. Ushikawa extinguished his now stubby cigarette. He was lost in thought for a while, and then he pulled out a new cigarette and lit it. He had decided years ago not to worry about getting lung cancer. If he wanted to concentrate, he had to get some nicotine into his system. Who knew what his fate was even 2 or 3 days down the road? So what was the point in worrying about how his health would be 15 years from now? As he smoked his third Seven Stars, an idea came to him. "Ah," he thought, "this might actually work."
Chapter 2. Aomame. Alone, but not lonely. When it got dark, she sat on a chair on the balcony and gazed out at the playground across the street. This was the most important part of her daily schedule, the focal point of her life. On sunny days, cloudy days, even when it rained, she kept a close watch, without missing a day. As October came around, the air grew cooler. On cold nights, she wore many layers, kept a blanket for her legs, and sipped hot cocoa. She watched the slide until 10:30, then took a leisurely bath to warm herself up and went to bed. Of course, there was a possibility that Tango might appear even in the daytime, but most likely he wouldn't. If he was going to show up at the park, it would be after the mercury vapor lamp went on and the moon was in the sky. Aomame had a quick supper, dressed so she could run outside, straightened her hair, then sat down on a garden chair and fixed her gaze on the slide. She always had an automatic pistol and a pair of small Nikon binoculars with her. Fearing that Tengo might appear if she went inside to the bathroom, she restricted her drinks to the hot cocoa. Aomame kept up her watch without missing a day. She didn't read, didn't listen to music, just stared at the park, her ears poised to catch any sound outside. She rarely even changed her position in the chair. She would raise her head from time to time and, if it was a cloudless night, look at the sky to make sure there were still 2 moons. And then she would quickly shift her gaze back to the park. As Aomame kept a close watch on the park, the moons kept a close watch over her. But Tengo didn't come. Not many people visited the playground at night. Occasionally, young lovers would appear. They would sit on a bench, hold hands, and like a pair of tiny birds, exchange a few short, nervous kisses. But the park was too small and too well lit. Soon they would grow restless and move on. Someone might show up or use a public toilet, find the door locked, and go away disappointed or perhaps angry. The occasional office worker on his way home from work would sometimes sit alone on the bench, head bowed, undoubtedly hoping to sober up. Or maybe he just didn't want to go straight home. And there was an old man who took his dog for a walk late at night. Both the dog and the man were taciturn and looked like they had given up all hope. Most of the time, though, the playground was empty at night. Not even a cat ran across it. Just the mercury vapor lamp's anonymous light illuminating the swings, the slide, the sandbox, the locked public toilet. When Ah Mame looked at this scene for a long time, she began to feel as if she had been abandoned on a deserted planet. Like that movie that showed the world after nuclear war. What was the title? On the Beach. Still, Ah Mame sat there, her mind focused as she kept watch over the playground. As if she were a sailor who had climbed a tall mast and was scanning the vast ocean in search of schools of fish or the ominous shadow of a periscope. Her watchful pair of eyes were on the lookout for one thing only. Tengo Kawana. Perhaps Tengo lived in some other town and had just happened to be passing by that night. In that case, the chances of his revisiting this park were close to zero. But Ah Mame didn't think so. When he sat on the slide that night, something about his manner and his clothes made her feel that he was taking a late-night stroll in the neighborhood, that he had stopped by the park and climbed up the slide, probably to get a better look at the moons, which meant he must live within walking distance. In the Koenji district, it wasn't easy to find a place to see the moon. The area was mostly flat, with hardly any tall buildings from which you could look at the sky. This made the slide in the playground a decent place to do so. It was quiet, and no one would bother you. If he decided he wanted to look at the moon again, he would show up. Ah Mame was certain of it. But then the next moment, a thought struck her. Things might not work out that easily. Maybe he's already found a better place to view the moon. Ah Mame gave a short, decisive shake of her head. She shouldn't overthink things. The only choice I have is to believe that Tengo will return to this playground and to wait here patiently until he does. I can't leave. This is the only point of contact between him and me. Ah Mame hadn't pulled the trigger. It was the beginning of September. She was standing in a turnout on the Metropolitan Expressway No. 3, in the midst of a traffic jam, bathed in bright morning sunlight, as she stuck the black muzzle of a Heckler & Koch in her mouth, dressed in a Junko Shimada suit and Charles Jourdan high heels. People were watching her from their cars, as if something was about to occur, but they had no idea what. There was a middle-aged woman in a silver Mercedes coupe. There were suntanned men looking down at her from the high cab of a freight truck. Ah Mame planned to blow her brains out right before their very eyes with a 9mm bullet. Taking her life was the only way she could vanish from this 1Q84 world. That way, she would be able to save Tengo's life. At least Leader had promised that. He had promised that much and sought his own death. Ah Mame didn't find it particularly disappointing that she had to die. Everything, she felt, had already been decided, ever since she was first pulled into this 1Q84 world. I'm just following the plan that has already been laid out. Continuing to live, alone, in this unreasonable world, where there are two moons in the sky, one large, one small, or something called little people control the destiny of others. What meaning could it have, anyway? In the end, though, she didn't pull the trigger. At the last moment, she relaxed her right index finger and removed the muzzle from her mouth. Like a person surfacing from deep underwater, she took a long breath and exhaled, as if replacing every molecule of air within her. She stopped moving toward death because she had heard a distant voice. At that point, she was in a soundless space. From the moment she put pressure on the trigger, all noise around her vanished. She was wrapped in silence, as if at the bottom of a pool. Down there, death was neither dark nor fearful. Like amniotic fluid to a fetus, it was natural, self-evident. "This isn't so bad," Ah Mama thought, and almost smiled. That was when she heard a voice. The voice sounded far away, as if coming from a distant time. She didn't recognize it. It reached her only after many twists and turns, and in the process, it lost its original tone and timbre. What was left was a hollow echo, stripped of meaning. Still, within that sound, Ah Mama could detect a warmth she hadn't felt for years. The voice seemed to be calling her name. She relaxed her finger on the trigger, narrowed her eyes, and listened carefully, trying to hear the words the voice was saying. But all she could make out, or thought that she made out, was her name. The rest was wind, whistling through a hollow space. In the end, the voice grew distant, lost any meaning at all, and was absorbed into the silence. The void enveloping her disappeared, and, as if a cork had been pulled, the noise and clamor around her rushed in, and she no longer wanted to die. "Maybe I can see Tengo one more time at that little playground," she thought. "I can die after that. I'll take a chance on that happening. Living, not dying, means the possibility of seeing Tengo again. I want to live," she decided. It was a strange feeling. Had she ever experienced that feeling before in her life? She released the hammer of the automatic pistol, set the safety, and put it inside her shoulder bag. She straightened up, put on her sunglasses, and walked in the opposite direction of traffic back to her taxi. People silently watched her, in her high heels striding down the expressway. She didn't have to walk for long. Even in the traffic jam, her taxi had managed to inch forward and had come up to where she was now standing. Ah Mama knocked on the window and the driver lowered it. "Can I get in again?" The driver hesitated. "That thing you put in your mouth over there looked like a pistol." It was. "A real one?" "No way," Ah Mama replied, curling her lips. The driver opened the door and she climbed in. She took the bag off her shoulder and laid it on the seat and wiped her mouth with her handkerchief. She could still taste the metal and the residue of gun oil. "So, did you find an emergency stairway?" the driver asked. Ah Mama shook her head. "I'm not surprised. I never heard of an emergency stairway anywhere around here," the driver said. "Would you still like to get off at the Ikejiri exit?"
"Yes, that would be fine," Ah Mama replied.
The driver rolled down his window, stuck his hand out, and pulled over into the right lane in front of a large bus. The meter in the cab was unchanged from when she had gotten out. Ah Mama leaned back against the seat, and breathing slowly, she gazed at the familiar Esso billboard. The huge tiger was looking in her direction, smiling, with a gas hose in his paw. "Put a tiger in your tank," the ad read. "Put a tiger in your tank," she whispered.
"Excuse me?"
the driver said, glancing at her in the rearview mirror.
"Nothing. Just talking to myself."
"I think I'll stay alive here a bit longer
and see with my own eyes what's going to happen. I can still die after that. It won't be too late. Probably. The day after she gave up on killing herself, Tamaru called her. So Al-Mame told him that the plan had changed, that she was going to stay put and not change her name or get plastic surgery. On the other end of the line, Tamaru was silent. Several theories noiselessly aligned themselves in his mind.
In other words, you're saying you don't want to move to another location?
Correct, Al-Mame replied. I would like to stay here for the time being.
That place is not set up to hide someone for an extended period.
If I stay inside and don't go out, they shouldn't find me.
Don't underestimate them,
Tamaru said.
They will do everything they can to pinpoint who you are and hunt you down. And you won't be the only one in danger. It could involve those around you. If that happens, I could be put in a difficult position.
I'm very sorry about that, but I need a bit more time.
A bit more time? That's a little vague,
Tamaru said.
That's the only way I can put it.
Tamaru was silent, in thought. He seemed to have sensed how firm her decision was.
I have to keep my priorities straight, he said. Do you understand that?
I think so. Tamaru was silent again, and then continued.
All right. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't misunderstanding. Since you insist on staying, you must have your reasons.
I do, Al-Mame said. Tamaru briefly cleared his throat.
As I have told you before, we have committed to take you someplace safe and far away. To erase any trail, change your face and name. Maybe it won't be a total transformation, but as close to total as we can manage. I thought we were agreed on this.
Of course I understand. I'm not saying I don't like the plan itself. It's just that something unexpected occurred, and I need to stay put for a while longer.
I am not authorized to say yes or no to this,
Tamaru said, making a faint sound in the back of his throat.
It might take a while to get an answer.
I'll be here, Al-Mame said.
Glad to hear it,
Tamaru said, and hung up. The phone rang the next morning just before 9. 3 rings, then it stopped, and rang again. It had to be Tamaru. Tamaru launched right in without saying hello.
Madame also is concerned about you staying there for very long. It is just a safe house, and it is not totally secure. Both of us agree that it's best to move you somewhere far away. Somewhere more secure. Do you follow me?
I do.
But you are a calm, cautious person. You don't make stupid mistakes, and I know you are committed. We trust you implicitly.
I appreciate that.
If you insist you want to stay in that place for a bit longer, then you must have your reasons. We don't know what your rationale is, but I'm sure it's not just a whim. So she is thinking that she would like to follow your wishes as much as she can.
Al-Mame said nothing. Tamaru continued.
You can stay there until the end of the year, but that's the limit.
After the first of the year, then, I need to move to another place.
Please understand, we are doing our very best to respect your wishes.
I understand, Al-Mame said. I'll be here until the end of the year. Then I will move. But this wasn't her real intention. She didn't plan to take one step out of this apartment until she saw Tengo again. If she mentioned this now, though, complications would set in. She could delay things for over 3 months, until the end of the year. After that, she would consider what to do next.
Fine, Tamaru said. We'll deliver food and other necessities once a week. At 1 p.m. each Tuesday, the supply masters will stop by. They have a key, so they can get in on their own. They will only go to the kitchen, nowhere else. While they are at the apartment, I want you to go into the back bedroom and lock the door.
Don't show your face or speak. When they're leaving, they will ring the doorbell once. Then you can come out of the bedroom. If there's anything special you need, let me know right now, and I'll have it included in the next delivery.
It would be nice to have equipment so I could do some strength training, Al-Mama said. There's only so much you can do exercising and stretching without equipment.
Full-scale gym equipment is out of the question. But we could supply some home equipment, the kind that doesn't take up much space.
Something very basic would be fine, Al-Mama said.
A stationary bike and some auxiliary equipment for strength training. Would that do it?
That would be great. If possible, I'd also like to get a metal softball bat.
Tamaru was silent for a few seconds.
A bat has many uses, Al-Mama explained. Just having it next to me makes me calm. It's like I grew up with the bat in my hand.
Okay. I'll get one for you, Tamaru said. If you think of anything else you need, write it on a piece of paper and leave it on the kitchen counter. I'll make sure you get it the next time we bring supplies.
Thank you. But I think I have everything I need.
How about books and videos and the like?
I can't think of anything I particularly want.
How about Proust's In Search of Lost Time?
Tamaru asked.
If you've never read it, this would be a good opportunity to read the whole thing.
Have you read it?
No. I've never been in jail or had to hide out for a long time. Someone once said unless you have those kinds of opportunities, you can't read the whole of Proust.
Do you know anybody who has read the whole thing?
I've known some people who have spent a long period in jail, but none were the type to be interested in Proust.
I'd like to give it a try, Al-Mama said. If you can get a hold of those books, bring them the next time you bring supplies.
Actually, I already got them for you, Tamaru said.
The so-called supply masters came on Tuesday afternoon at 1 p.m. on the dot. As instructed, Al-Mama went into the back bedroom, locked it from the inside, and tried not to make a sound. She heard the front door being unlocked and people opening the door and coming in. Al-Mama had no idea what kind of people these supply masters were. From the sounds they made, she got the feeling there were two of them, but she didn't hear any voices. They carried in several boxes and silently went about putting things away. She heard them at the sink, rinsing off the food they had bought, and then stacking it in the fridge. They must have decided beforehand who would be in charge of what. They unwrapped some boxes, and she could hear them folding up the wrapping paper and containers. It sounded like they were wrapping up the kitchen garbage as well. Al-Mama couldn't take the bag of garbage downstairs to the collection spot, so she had to have somebody take it for her. The people seemed to do their work efficiently, with no wasted effort. They tried not to make any unnecessary noise, and their footsteps, too, were quiet. They were finished in about 20 minutes. Then they opened the front door and left. She heard them lock the front door from the outside, and then the doorbell rang once as a signal. To be on the safe side, Al-Mama waited 15 minutes. Then she exited the bedroom, made sure no one else was there, and locked the deadbolt on the front door. The large fridge was crammed full of a week's worth of food. This time it wasn't the kind of food you popped in the microwave, but mostly fresh groceries, a variety of fruits and vegetables, fish and meat, tofu, wakame, and natto, milk, cheese, and orange juice, a dozen eggs. So there wouldn't be any extra garbage. They had taken everything out of their original containers and then neatly rewrapped them in plastic wrap. They had done a good job understanding the type of food she normally ate. How would they know this? She wondered. A stationary bicycle was set down next to the window. A small but high-end model. The digital display on it showed speed, distance, and calories burned. You could also monitor RPMs and heart rate. There was a bench press to work on abs, deltoids, and triceps, the kind of equipment that was easy to assemble and disassemble. Al-Mame was quite familiar with it. It was the newest type, a very simple design yet very effective. With these two pieces of equipment, she would have no trouble keeping in shape. A metal bat in a soft case was there as well. Al-Mame took it out of the case and took a few swings. The shiny new silver bat swished sharply through the air. The old familiar heft of it calmed her. The feel of the bat in her hands brought back memories of her teenage years and the time she had spent with Tamaki Otsuka. All 7 volumes of In Search of Lost Time were piled up on the dining table. They were not new copies, but they appeared to be unread. Al-Mame flipped through one. There were several magazines, too, weekly and monthly magazines, and 5 brand new videos still in their plastic wrap. She had no idea who had chosen them, but they were all new movies she had never seen. She was not in the habit of going to movie theaters, so there were always a lot of new films that she missed. There were 3 brand new sweaters in a large department store shopping bag in different thicknesses. There were 2 thick flannel shirts and 4 long-sleeve t-shirts. All of them were in plain fabric and simple designs. They were all the perfect size. There were also some thick socks and tights. If she was going to be here until December, she would need them. Her handlers knew what they were doing. She took the clothes into the bedroom and folded them to store in drawers or hung them on hangers in the closet. She had gone back to the kitchen and was drinking coffee when the phone rang. It rang 3 times, stopped, then rang again. "Did you get everything?" Tamaru asked. "Yes, thank you. I think I have everything I need now. The exercise equipment is more than enough. Now I just have to crack open Proust. If there is anything that we've overlooked, don't hesitate to tell me." "I won't," Al-Mame said, "though I don't think it would be easy to find anything you have overlooked." Tamaru cleared his throat. "This might not be my business, but do you mind if I give you a warning?" "Go right ahead." "Unless you have experienced it, being shut up in a small place by yourself, unable to see or talk to anyone else, is not the easiest thing in the world. No matter how tough a person might be, eventually he is going to make a sound, especially when someone is after you."
"I haven't been living in very spacious places up till now."
"That could be an advantage," Tamaru said. "Still, I want you to be very careful. If a person remains tense for a long time, he might not notice it himself, but it's like his nerves are a piece of rubber that has been stretched out. It's hard to go back to the original shape."
"I'll be careful," Al-Mame said.
"As I said before, you are a very cautious person. You're practical and patient, not overconfident. But no matter how careful a person might be, once your concentration slips, you will definitely make 1 or 2 mistakes. Loneliness becomes an acid that eats away at you."
"I don't think I'm lonely," Al-Mame declared. She said this half to Tamaru and half to herself. "I'm all alone, but I'm not lonely." There was a silence on the other end of the phone, as if Tamaru were giving serious thought to the difference between being alone and being lonely.
"At any rate, I'll be more cautious than I have been," Al-Mame said.
"Thank you for the advice."
"There is one thing I'd like you to understand," Tamaru said. "We will do whatever we can to protect you. But if some emergency arises, what that might be, I don't know, you may have to deal with it yourself. I can run over there as fast as possible and still might not make it in time. Depending on the situation, I may not be able to get there at all. For instance, if it is no longer desirable for us to have a connection with you."
"I understand completely. I plan to protect myself, with the bat, and with the thing you gave me. It's a tough world.
Wherever there's hope, there's a trial, Almama said.
Tamaru was silent again for a moment, and then spoke. Have you heard about the final test given to candidates to become interrogators for Stalin's secret police?
No, I haven't.
A candidate would be put in a square room. The only thing in the room is an ordinary small wooden chair. And the interrogator's boss gives him an order. He says, get this chair to confess and write up a report on it. Until you do this, you can't leave this room.
Sounds pretty surreal.
No, it isn't. It's not surreal at all. It's a real story. Stalin actually did create that kind of paranoia, and some 10 million people died on his watch. Most of them his fellow countrymen. And we actually live in that kind of world. Don't ever forget that.
You're full of heartwarming stories, aren't you?
Not really. I just have a few set aside, just in case. I never received a formal education. I just learned whatever looked useful, as I experienced it. Wherever there's hope, there's a trial. You're exactly right. Absolutely. Hope, however, is limited and generally abstract, while there are countless trials, and they tend to be concrete. That is also something I had to learn on my own.
So what kind of confession did the interrogator candidates extract from the chairs?
That is a question definitely worth considering,
Tamaru said.
Sort of like a Zen koan.
Stalinist Zen, Almama said. After a short pause, Tamaru hung up. That afternoon, she worked out on the stationary bike and the bench press. Almama enjoyed the moderate workout, her first in a while. Afterward, she showered, then made dinner while listening to an FM station. In the evening, she checked the TV news, though not a single item caught her interest. After the sun had set, she went out to the balcony to watch the playground, with her usual blanket, binoculars, and pistol, and her shiny brand new bat. If Tenko doesn't show up by then, she thought, I guess I will see out this enigmatic year of 1Q84 in this corner of Koenji, one monotonous day after another. I'll cook, exercise, check the news, and work my way through Proust, and wait for Tenko to show up at the playground. Waiting for him is a central task of my life. Right now, that slender thread is what is barely keeping me alive. It's like that spider I saw when I was climbing down the emergency stairway on the Metropolitan Expressway number 3. A tiny black spider that had spun a pathetic little web in a corner of a grimy steel frame and was silently lying in wait. The wind from under the bridge had blown the spider web, which hung there precariously, tattered and full of dust. When I first saw it, I thought it was pitiful. But right now I'm in the same situation. I have to get a hold of a recording of Janáček's Sinfonietta. I need it when I'm working out. It makes me feel connected. It's as if that music is leading me to something. To what, though? I can't say. She made a mental note to add that to the next list of supplies. It was October now. There was less than 3 months left of her reprieve. The clock kept ticking away ceaselessly. Almama sank down into her garden chair and continued to watch the slide in the playground through the plastic blinds. The little children's playground looked pale under the mercury vapor lamp. The scene made Almama think of deserted hallways in an aquarium at night. Invisible, imaginary fish were swimming noiselessly through the trees, never halting their silent movements. And two moons hung in the sky, waiting for Almama's acknowledgement. Tengo, she whispered, where are you?
Chapter 3. Tengo. The animals all wore clothes. In the afternoons, Tengo would visit his father in the hospital, sit next to his bed, open the book he brought, and read aloud. After reading 5 pages, he would take a short break, then read 5 more pages. He read whatever book he happened to be reading on his own at the time. Sometimes it was a novel, or a biography, or a book on the natural sciences. What was most important was the act of reading the sentences aloud, not the contents. Tengo didn't know if his father actually heard his voice. His face never showed any reaction. This thin, shabby-looking old man had his eyes closed, and he was asleep. He didn't move at all, and his breathing wasn't audible. He was breathing, but unless you brought your ear very close or held a mirror up to his nose to see if it clouded, you couldn't really tell. The liquid in the IV drip went into his body, and a tiny amount of urine oozed out the catheter. The only thing that revealed that he was alive was this silent, slow movement in and out. Occasionally a nurse would shave his beard with an electric razor and use a tiny pair of scissors with rounded-off tips to clip the white hairs growing out of his ears and nose. She would trim his eyebrows as well. Even though he was unconscious, these continued to grow. As he watched his father, Tengo started to have doubts about the difference between a person being alive and being dead. Maybe there really wasn't much of a difference to begin with, he thought. Maybe we just decided, for convenience's sake, to insist on a difference. At 3, the doctor came and gave Tengo an update on his father's condition. The explanation was always concise, and it was nearly the same from one day to the next. There was no change. The old man was simply asleep, his life gradually fading away. In other words, death was approaching, slowly but certainly, and there was nothing medically speaking that could be done. Just let him lie here, quietly sleeping. That's about all the doctor could say. In the evenings, 2 male nurses would come and take his father to an examination room. The male nurses differed depending on the day, but both of them were taciturn. Perhaps the masks they wore had something to do with it, but they never said a word. One of them looked foreign. He was short and dark-skinned and was always smiling at Tengo through his mask. Tengo could tell he was smiling by his eyes. Tengo smiled back and nodded. Anywhere from a half hour to an hour later, his father would be brought back to his room. Tengo had no idea what kind of examinations they were conducting. While his father was gone, he would go to the cafeteria, have some hot green tea, and stay about 15 minutes before going back to the hospital room. All the while, he held on to the hope that when he returned, an air chrysalis would once again materialize, with Aomami as a young girl lying inside. But all that greeted him in the gloomy hospital room was the smell of a sick person and the depressions left behind in the empty bed. Tengo stood by the window and looked at the scene outside. Beyond the garden and lawn was the dark line of the pine windbreak, through which came the sound of waves, the rough waves of the Pacific. It was a thick, darkish sound, as if many souls were gathered, each whispering his story. They seemed to be seeking more souls to join them, seeking even more stories to be told. Before this, in October, Tengo had twice taken day trips, on his days off, to the sanatorium in Chikura. He would take the early morning express train. Once there, he would sit beside his father's bed and talk to him sometimes. There was nothing even close to a response. His father just lay there, face up, sound asleep. Tengo spent most of his time gazing out the window. As evening approached, he waited for something to happen, but nothing ever did. The sun would silently sink, and the room would be wrapped in the gathering gloom. He would ultimately give up, leave, and take the last express train back to Tokyo. "Maybe I should be more patient, stay with him longer," Tengo thought once. "Maybe visiting him for the day and then leaving isn't enough. What's needed, perhaps, is a deeper commitment." He had no concrete evidence that this was true. He just felt that way. After the middle of November, he took the vacation leave he had accumulated, telling the cram school that his father was in critical condition and he needed to look after him. This in itself wasn't a lie. He asked a classmate from college to take over his classes. He was one of the relatively few people with whom Tengo had kept in touch, albeit just once or twice a year. Even in the math department, which had more than its share of oddballs, this guy was particularly odd, as well as smart beyond compare. After graduating, though, he didn't get a job or go on to grad school. Instead, when he felt like it, he taught math at a private cram school for junior high students. Other than that, he read, went fly fishing, and did whatever he wanted. Tengo happened to know, however, that he was a very capable teacher. The thing was, he was tired of being so capable. Plus, he was from a wealthy family, and there was no need for him to force himself to work. He had substituted for Tengo once before, and the students had liked him. Tengo called him and explained the situation, and he immediately agreed to step in. There was also the question of what to do about Fukaeri. Tengo couldn't decide if leaving this naive girl behind in his apartment for a long time was the right thing to do. And besides, she was trying to hide out, to stay out of sight. So he asked her directly, "Are you okay on your own here for a while, or would you like to go someplace else temporarily?" "Where are you going?" Fukaeri asked, a serious look in her eyes. "To the cat town," Tengo explained. "My father won't regain consciousness. He's been in a deep sleep for a while. They say he might not last long." He didn't say a word about the air chrysalis appearing in the hospital room bed one evening, or how Aomami appeared inside as a young girl asleep, or how the air chrysalis was exactly as Fukaeri had described it in her novel, down to the last detail, or how he was secretly hoping that it would again appear before him. Fukaeri narrowed her eyes, pursed her lips, and stared straight at Tengo, as if trying to make out a message written in tiny letters. Almost unconsciously, he touched his face, but it didn't feel as though something was written on it. "That's fine," Fukaeri said after a while, and she nodded several times. "Do not worry about me. I will stay at home." After thinking for a moment, she added, "Right now there is no danger." "Right now there is no danger," Tengo repeated. "Do not worry about me," she said again. "I'll call you every day. Do not get abandoned in the cat town." "I'll be careful," Tengo said. Tengo went to the supermarket and bought enough food so Fukaeri wouldn't have to go shopping, all things that would be simple to prepare. Tengo was well aware that she had neither the ability nor the desire to do much cooking. He wanted to avoid coming back in 2 weeks to a fridge full of mushy, spoiled food. He stuffed a vinyl bag full of clothes and toiletries, a few books, pens, and paper. As usual, he took the express train from Tokyo Station, changed to a local train at Tateyama, and got off at Chikura. He went to the tourist information booth in front of the station to look for a fairly inexpensive hotel. It was the off-season, so he had no trouble finding a room in a simple Japanese-style inn that catered mainly to people coming to fish. The cramped but clean room smelled of fresh tatami. The fishing harbor was visible from the second-floor window. The charge for the room, which included breakfast, was cheaper than he had expected. "I don't know yet how long I'll be staying," Tengo said, "but I'll go ahead and pay for 3 days." The proprietress of the inn had no objection. The doors shut at 11, and bringing a woman to his room would be problematic, she explained in a roundabout way. All this sounded fine to him. Once he settled into his room, he phoned the sanatorium. He told the nurse, the same middle-aged nurse he had met before, that he would like to visit his father at 3 p.m. and asked if that would be convenient. "That would be fine," she replied. "Mr. Kawana just sleeps all the time," she said. Thus began Tengo's days at the cat town beside the sea. He would get up early, take a walk along the shore, watch the fishing boats go in and out of the harbor, then return to the inn for breakfast. Breakfast was exactly the same every day: dried horse mackerel and fried eggs, a quartered tomato, seasoned dried seaweed, miso soup with shijimi clams, and rice. But for some reason it tasted wonderful every morning. After breakfast, he would sit at a small desk and write. He hadn't written in some time and found the act of writing with his fountain pen enjoyable. Working in an unfamiliar place, away from your daily routine, was invigorating. The engines of the fishing boats chugged monotonously as they pulled into the harbor. Tengo liked the sound. The story he was writing began with a world where there were two moons in the sky, a world of little people and air chrysalises. He had borrowed this world from Fukairi's air chrysalis, but by now it was entirely his own. As he wrote, his mind was living in that world. Even when he lay down his pen and stood up from the desk, his mind remained there. There was a special sensation of his body and his mind beginning to separate, and he could no longer distinguish the real world from the fictional. The protagonist of the story who entered the cat town probably experienced the same sensation. Before he knew it, the world's center of gravity had shifted, and the protagonist would, most likely, be unable to ever board the train to get out of town. At 11, Tengo had to leave his room so they could clean it. When the time came, he stopped writing, went out, walked to the front of the station, and drank coffee in a nearby coffee shop. Occasionally he would have a light sandwich, but usually he ate nothing. He would then pick up the morning paper and check it closely to see if there was any article that might have something to do with him. He found no such article. Air Chrysalis had long since disappeared from the bestseller lists. Number one on the list now was a diet book entitled, Eat as Much as You Want of the Food You Love and Still Lose Weight. What a great title. The whole book could be blank inside and it would still sell. After he finished his coffee and was done with the paper, Tengo took the bus to the sanatorium. He usually arrived between 1:30 and 2. He chatted a bit with the nurse, who was always at the front desk. When Tengo began staying in the town and visiting his father every day, the nurses grew kinder to him and treated him in a friendly way, as warmly as the prodigal son's family must have welcomed him back home. One of the younger nurses always gave an embarrassed smile whenever she saw Tengo. She seemed to have a crush on him. She was petite, wore her hair in a ponytail, and had big eyes and red cheeks. She was probably in her early 20s, but ever since the air chrysalis had appeared with the sleeping girl inside, all Tengo could think about was Ao Mame. All other women were faint shadows in comparison. An image of Ao Mame was constantly playing at the edges of his mind. Ao Mame was alive somewhere in this world. He could feel it. He knew she must be searching for him, which is why on that evening she chose to find him. She had not forgotten him either. If what I saw wasn't an illusion. Sometimes he remembered his older girlfriend and wondered how she was. She's irretrievably lost now, her husband had said on the phone. She can no longer visit your home. Irretrievably lost. Even now those words gave Tengo an uncomfortable, uneasy feeling. They had an undeniably ominous ring. Still, she became less and less of a presence in his mind as time went on. He could recall the afternoons they had spent together only as events in the past, undertaken to fulfill certain goals. Tengo felt guilty about this, but before he had known it, gravity had changed. It had shifted, and it wouldn't be going back to its original location. When he arrived at his father's room, Tengo would sit in the chair next to his bed and briefly greet him. Then he would explain, in chronological order, what he had done since the previous night. He hadn't done much. He had gone back to town on the bus, had a simple dinner at a restaurant, drunk a beer, returned to the inn, and read. He'd gone to bed at 10. In the morning he would take a walk, eat breakfast, and work on his novel for about 2 hours. He repeated the same things every day, but even so, Tengo gave the unconscious man a detailed report on all his activities. There was no response from his listener. It was like talking to a wall, a formality he had to go through. Still, sometimes simple repetition has meaning. Then Tengo would read from the book he had brought along. He didn't stick to just one book. He would read aloud from the book that he himself was reading at the time. If a manual for an electric lawnmower had been his current reading material, that's what he would have read. Tengo read in a deliberately clear voice, slowly, so that it was easy to understand. That was the one thing he made sure to do. The lightning outside grew steadily stronger, and for a while the greenish light illuminated the road, but there was no rumble of thunder. Maybe there was thunder, but he felt unfocused. It was as if he couldn't hear it. Rainwater flowed in small rivers along the road. After wading through the water, customers came into the shop, one after another. His friend turned and stared. He went strangely quiet. There was a sudden commotion as customers pushed toward them, making it hard to breathe. Someone cleared his throat, perhaps because a piece of food had gotten stuck. It was a strange voice, more of a snuffling cough, as if it were a dog. Suddenly, there was a huge flash of lightning that shone all the way inside the place, illuminating the people on the dirt floor. And just then, a clap of thunder sounded, ready to crack the roof. Surprised, he stood up, and the crowd of people at the entrance turned as one to face him. Then he saw that theirs were the faces of animals, dogs or foxes, he wasn't sure, and the animals all wore clothes, and some of them had long tongues hanging out, licking around the corners of their mouths. Tengo read to there and looked at his father's face. "The end," he said. The story stopped there. No reaction. "What do you think?" As expected, there was no response from his father. Sometimes he would read what he himself had written that morning. After he had read it, he would rewrite in ballpoint pen the parts he wasn't satisfied with, and reread the parts he had edited. If he still wasn't satisfied at the way it sounded, he would rewrite it again, and then read the new version. "The rewritten version is better," he said to his father, as if hoping he would agree. His father predictably didn't express an opinion. He didn't say it was better, or that the earlier version was better, or that there really wasn't much of a difference between the two. The lids on his sunken eyes were shut tight, like a sad house with its heavy shutters lowered. Sometimes Tengo would stand up from his chair and stretch and go to the window and look at the scenery outside. After several overcast days, it was raining. The continual afternoon rain made the pine windbreak dark and heavy. He couldn't hear the waves at all. There was no wind, just the rain falling straight down from the sky. A flock of blackbirds flew by in the rain. The hearts of those birds were dark, and wet, too. The inside of the room was also wet. Everything there, pillows, books, desk, was damp. But oblivious to it all, to the weather, the damp, the wind, the sound of the waves, his father continued in an uninterrupted coma. Like a merciful cloak, paralysis enveloped his body. After a short break, Tengo went back to reading aloud. In the damp, narrow room, that was all he was able to do. When he tired of reading aloud, Tengo sat there, gazing at the form of his sleeping father and trying to surmise what kinds of things were going through his brain. Inside, in the inner parts of that stubborn skull, like an old anvil, what sort of consciousness lay hidden there? Or was there nothing left at all? Was it like an abandoned house from which all the possessions and appliances had been moved, leaving no trace of those who had once dwelled there? Even if it was, there should be the occasional memory or scenery etched into the walls and ceilings. Things cultivated over such a long time don't just vanish into nothingness. As his father lay on this plain bed in the sanatorium by the shore, at the same time he might very well be surrounded by scenes and memories invisible to others in the still darkness of a back room in his own vacant house. The young nurse with the red cheeks would come in, smile at Tengo, then take his father's temperature, check how much remained in the IV drip, and measure the amount of urine he had produced. She would note all the numbers down on a clipboard. Her actions were automatic and brisk, as if prescribed in a training manual. Tengo watched this series of movements and wondered how she must feel to live her life in this sanatorium by the sea, taking care of senile old people whose prognosis was grim. She looked young and healthy. Beneath her starched uniform, her waist and her breasts were compact but ample. Golden down glistened on her smooth neck. The plastic name tag on her chest read Adachi. What could possibly have brought her to this remote place, where oblivion and listless death lay hovering over everything? Tengo could tell she was a skilled and hard-working nurse. She was still young and worked quite efficiently. She could have easily worked in some other field of healthcare, something more lively and engaging. So why did she choose this sad sort of place to work? Tengo wondered.